Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Later this hour, the fashion industry is a big polluter and local entrepreneurs are hoping to bring about change. But first, Omicron is slamming the Delaware Valley. COVID cases and hospitalizations are rising across the region. In Philadelphia, average number of daily new cases was over 3,500 as of Friday. Testing is at a premium. It's really hard to get a hold of a rapid at-home kit these days. And Philly officials are warning residents to be wary of sketchy pop-up testing sites. In addition, many schools are opting for a temporary return to online learning. We're going to open today's show with the latest on this post-holiday COVID wave and how it's affecting the immediate Philly area. Philadelphia's Health Commissioner Cheryl Bettegol joins us now. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So I've read that the rate of new cases in Philly is the highest it's been at any time during the pandemic. Is that true?
Yeah, cases now are far higher than they were during earlier peaks. So although Omicron is less severe, the numbers we're seeing have led to skyrocketing hospitalizations as well.
How are hospitals faring? If hospitalizations are skyrocketing, are you hearing that staff is under more stress now than ever?
Yeah, and, you know, we've asked that everybody who doesn't have an emergency stay away from the hospital emergency rooms, because they really are just packed with people coming who maybe either don't have symptoms but want to test, or have mild symptoms, head cold symptoms, or some cough, but don't really need an emergency room. So it's really important right now, with the huge number of people who do have COVID, that we remember that emergency rooms and hospitals are really for people with emergencies and reasons that they need to be there.
Let's talk about challenges, Dr. Bettegol, in testing for COVID. First of all, the pop-up sites. There's been some controversy about some of these sites that are showing up in Philly and whether they're legit. What is the health department saying here?
So we're asking people to be careful, and we are working, you know, we've never had to do this before. It's never come up before, but we are working on a way of either permitting or licensing pop-up sites to help give people something else they can count on. But until we have that up and running, which will just take us a little bit, you know, look carefully. If it is a pop-up site that's not at an institution that you know of and it's just on a sidewalk somewhere, you know, be a little bit skeptical. Check. If they have a logo, look on the site that they list. You know, if they say they're from FEMA, for example, as this recent site did, check on the FEMA site. Is there anything listed there? You can call our COVID hotline if you have questions. That's the 685-5488 number. And, you know, our staff will be happy to walk you through something. We don't know for sure that these are scams, but we don't know that they're not. And we just want want people to be cautious.
It can be really hard to find an at-home test right now, not only in Philly, but in the suburbs in South Jersey. I mean, I've heard they're delivered to pharmacies and they're out the door in a half an hour. So for the person who needs that information quickly, what do you recommend?
Well, firstly, we are recommending that right now, given the prevalence of COVID, anybody with COVID-like symptoms, head cold, loss of taste or smell, although that's less common with this, cough, fever, headache, just assume it's COVID and act accordingly if you don't have access to a test. The most important thing is that you not infect other people, not that you know 100% for sure whether this is COVID or not. And then, you know, if you can test, that's great. In terms of testing availability, we do have information at Philly.gov/testing for people who do need a test. The new FEMA site at the Body Rec Center gives us an extra roughly 500 tests a day that we can do in the city. But it really is a stretch. There's a national shortage of home tests, which would really be the ideal thing for people to be able to use quickly and easily.
Sure. What's the latest on getting rapid tests from the federal government? Have you heard anything?
Well, so the federal government has made this promise to mail tests to people, to come up with 500 million tests. And I think my understanding is that they don't yet have those tests, but are acquiring them. People will be able to sign up on a website for them. And then people, and this is a big group of people who are uninsured or people who are on Medicaid or Medicare. So this is more than half of Philadelphia's children, for example, and about 30% of Philadelphia's adults. Would not be able to get reimbursed through their insurer, which is another mechanism, but would be able to get them through community sites, community health centers, and so on. But there's a lot to still be worked out in this federal plan. The idea, the third piece of it is this reimbursement through insurers, but that relies on the availability of tests. So we're hoping that this gets really fully developed in the next couple of weeks, because we really do need this availability.
Sure. We're speaking with Philadelphia's Health Commissioner, Dr. Cheryl Bettegol. We've got a question from Margie, who says, I'm conflicted about when someone should get tested, since it isn't easy and can require some time off from work and income loss. And again, just go over the symptoms for us, Dr. Bettegol. What symptoms, she asks, what level of exposure means you must get tested?
You know, at this stage, there isn't really a must get tested. There is a must protect others. And must protect others right now is anybody who has symptoms that could be COVID. So fever, cough, headache, nasal congestion, runny nose, sore throat. Loss of taste and smell, again, is less common, but is associated with COVID. Less commonly, GI symptoms. So if you're having symptoms, you want to first protect others. So, you know, whether or not you can get tested, make sure you don't go to places where you're going to be hanging out with other people, whether that's socially or at work. Make sure you're masking really carefully if, for whatever reason, you have to go somewhere right now. But really, you want to be at home and protecting other people from getting those symptoms. If you have an employer who's going to require a COVID test, that is when those COVID sites, the testing sites at phila.gov/testing, can be most useful to you. But, given the shortage of tests, I do think that it's an important option for people to simply assume that they have COVID. Yeah. And act accordingly.
Let's talk about Omicron and how it differs from Delta. We've heard that it can be less severe than Delta, but mm-hmm. I've also seen reports that it can be just as dangerous to the unvaccinated. Is that the case?
Well, it does appear to be milder. It does appear that the rate of hospitalizations among people who have Omicron is lower than that of people who had Delta or some of the earlier variants. But the problem is that it is so much more infectious that, even if it's half as severe, if we're seeing three times, four times, five times as many cases, we will end up with more people hospitalized and more deaths. And as we start seeing numbers of hospitalizations skyrocketing and deaths start to rise, I think we have to recognize that even a less severe variant is something we have to take very, very seriously.
Many of us, when we mask up, use cloth masks. There's been a question about how effective cloth is when it comes to Omicron. What is the latest from the CDC?
So, there has been a stress from the CDC, from local health departments, on kind of upping your mask game. So if you were just using a cloth mask alone, that against Omicron is probably not enough, especially for any exposure that goes on for more than a few minutes. So, there's a few options out there. There are N95 masks. Those have to be fit tested. And, one of the things I see a lot with people who are not medical personnel using an N95 is letting that mask have gaps because it makes it more comfortable. But it also makes it not nearly as useful. So if you're not somebody who's been fit tested with an N95, you're not confident that you can wear it sealed tight against your face, your other options are a KN95, which is that one that forms sort of a V out from your face, which is just about as good, or using a cloth mask over a paper mask. And that's actually what I recommend for most situations that are not a very high risk exposure, because it's almost as effective as an N95, very easy to tolerate, very affordable, and readily available to most of us.
It's been about a week since a new protocol went into effect in the city, mandating that anyone going into restaurants or movie theaters or other indoor venues that, where food is served, that patrons must be vaccinated or show a negative COVID test. Cheryl Bettegol, do you think this is helping to boost the vaccination rate in the city?
I do. I mean, both from what we're seeing in the numbers, we're seeing more people getting vaccinated, and also from what I'm hearing from physicians in the community. Seeing families coming in saying, okay, I do want to get my kids vaccinated because I'm just not able to take them anywhere, for example, or people getting vaccinated because their work now requires them to. So I think it's going to help us. We still need every little bit of help we can to get people vaccinated and protected in other ways.
Yeah. How long do you think this mandate might remain in place?
you know, it's hard to predict because everything with COVID has been hard to predict. So it depends how long this extreme surge is with us. You know, it was in response to the increasing number of cases, hospitalizations, and so on that we needed this mandate. So we're going to watch numbers carefully. Would love to roll things back as soon as that's possible.
Yeah. And if you do go out again, best to social distance as much as possible.
Yes. And I think one of the other things that doesn't get talked about nearly enough is that guideline to stay at least 6 feet apart from people and then an exposure is within 6 feet for 15 minutes is probably no longer valid with Omicron.
Okay.
We don't really know what distance. More distance is better than less distance. And shorter time is better than longer time. But I wouldn't count on 6 feet being enough.
So what would you recommend then? Just as far away as possible?
Well, I really recommend outside because the ventilation you get outside is better than anything in any indoor space. But obviously, it's very cold on days like today. So if you are going to be inside, making sure you're masked, being as far away from others as you can.
Okay. At schools, Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is now recommending that teachers and staff who test positive be allowed to return 5 days after the start of symptoms. Where is the city health department on this?
So we are still actively talking to our own internal infectious disease experts, schools experts, to the School District of Philadelphia, and to our colleagues at Policy Lab. We do have some concerns with that 5 day everybody back guidance in terms of the number of people who will still be contagious at that point, but recognize that it is really critically important that kids be in person for learning as much as possible.
And by the way, we will be discussing schools at length in our next segment, so stay with us for that. So, Cheryl Bettegold, seems like we get through one COVID wave and another variant is close behind. Is there any sense in the scientific community as to what's next or when we might start to move away from this pandemic?
Yeah, you know, despite the fact that January looks pretty bleak for all of us, there is a little bit of a sense of hope on the horizon because so many people are vaccinated. And, you know, especially people who are boosted do have good protection against this variant. And particularly because there seems to have finally been recognition that we need to vaccinate the rest of the world. And we know that these variants are emerging in countries where vaccination rates have been very low and lots of people remain at risk and are kind of perfect vectors for this vaccine to replicate and grow and change. And so, you know, we need to protect everybody in order to protect ourselves, essentially. And I think with this variant, that seems to have hit home in terms of national policy in a way that I haven't seen previously.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Cheryl Bettegold, thank you so much. A pleasure.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too. Cheryl Bettegold is Health Commissioner for the City of Philadelphia. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we talk about the effect of all this on schools, many of which are switching, at least temporarily, to virtual learning. Ashley Benkin is a former Philly school teacher and New Jersey state policymaker and co-founder of Connected Workforce. She will be our guest. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. COVID is once again hitting schools hard.
Kids falling behind in their academic progress because of the pandemic. Already, students have lost an average of 6.8 months of learning so far.
The consensus here at Children's Hospital is that preserving as much in-person instruction for kids outweighs the risk of COVID infection.
The American Academy of Pediatrics has declared the state of mental health for children and adolescents a national emergency.
A staffing shortage now is leaving some school districts understaffed or in a bind.
Many school districts in the Delaware Valley find themselves in a place almost impossible to imagine a year ago. Administrators have made the decision to go back to virtual learning, at least temporarily. Students, teachers, bus drivers, custodians, and other staff are out because of COVID. Substitutes are difficult to find, and superintendents say the top priority is safety. Suffice it to say, it's been a tough term so far, coming on the heels of the unprecedented change first wrought by the 2020 school year. We're going to turn our attention to the effect this is having on young children, teens, and educators, and we'll take your calls and comments as well. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Our guest is Ashley Benkin. She's a former Philadelphia school teacher and New Jersey State policymaker. Benkin also is co-founder of Connected Workforce, an education consulting group. Welcome to the Roundup, Ashley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It's such a stressful time. Let's start with where learning has been impacted most over the last 2 years. You say math has taken an incredible hit.
Yeah, so a lot of the work I've been doing over the last 2 years has focused in New Jersey. And so what's been going on over there is that the state has provided a way for both parents, teachers, schools to kind of have a snapshot on how their kids have been doing against state standards. And they just released a report that kind of shows that most children across the grade levels are in a level one, or they need heavy support in recovering their math skills. And that's not shocking. Math typically builds in a spiraling effect. So if, you know, you were in some critical courses during virtual learning, or had, you know, been impacted by staffing shortages and didn't get that content in a spiraling way, it's really hard to catch up. You can't just skip ahead, right, and jump from adding, subtracting to algebra. But I think we're also seeing that the lower grades and foundational reading skills, phonics, vocabulary, things like that, that unlock your ability to kind of grow and read further, is also equally low compared to normally where children would be this time in the school year.
How would you characterize this learning loss, you know, as we're kind of looking to the future a few years down the road as these kids are moving hopefully forward in grade level?
Yeah, what a great question. I think they don't get that time back, right? Our school system is so driven on you have 180 days every year, get what you can in, and then hopefully you can are ready to go on grade level that following year. So unprecedented is an overused word, but it could not be more, you know, more true that right now almost every single child is in need of more time, the ability to kind of recover the learning that they wouldn't have gotten on that schedule. And so I think anywhere that states or districts or parents and families can figure out how they can give that time back to their children is a strong way to support it. Because down the road, you know, the same challenges that we were having as an economy, whether it's Pennsylvania, New Jersey, or Delaware, or, you know, the United States as a whole, pre-pandemic, we couldn't staff certain jobs because we didn't have, you know, skilled professionals in those areas. And it all tracks back to, you know, foundational K-12 education. And so right now, if the majority of our, you know, K-12 students aren't getting a strong enough foundation to access whatever coursework, whether it be post-secondary or jumping right into careers, they aren't going to be ready or farther along like we need them to be to go into some of those higher skilled jobs that are in all the different technology STEM fields that were, you know, pre-pandemic, that's where our big shortages are. So it's pretty alarming. And I think, yeah, you know, that's the best word for it. It's like, okay, so now how do we both catch up right now, today, tomorrow, have empathy, and then think ahead and say, how are we going to make sure that, you know, the jobs we rely on every day will have people in the future and these shortages don't follow us for the next 10 years?
I want to talk about some of those points. But first, let's just for a moment look at learners in lower income districts as compared to their peers in wealthier areas and how they've been affected by the disruption. What have you observed, Ashley?
Sure. So I think it's important that people recognize that lost learning or students finishing a school year not having covered enough content is not new, unfortunately, if you have been in an under-resourced school district. I worked in the city of Philadelphia. Often, many of my students would come into my eighth grade classroom on a kindergarten or a third grade or a sixth grade, you know, level. And my goal as an educator was to both try to catch them up to eighth grade and then try to make them ready for ninth grade. And that's almost a Herculean task if you're coming in at kindergarten or third grade to then try to be ready for ninth grade all in the same amount of time as everybody else. And so those historic gaps haven't gone away, right? It's not like because of the pandemic, our children from school systems that didn't have, you know, the best resources when we talk about school buildings, curriculum, devices, access to education professionals that were the best and the brightest and able to pull someone from a kindergarten level, right, all the way to eighth grade in 1 year, you know, those things didn't go away. And so it's not surprising that they are even seeing now to having an even more of a loss than with their affluent peers. So in New Jersey, some data came out. On average, I think the state is estimating 3 months behind. Well, Black students, Latinx students, people, any student from a low-income background are looking at closer to six.
Oh, boy.
And so, yeah, and when we compound that with teacher shortages, right? So schools have been open, but if your teacher's not there, that person that you trust and has built that relationship with you, like, it's just going to keep perpetuating it. So we really need to focus on that.
Let's talk about what lies immediately ahead and talk some more about stemming the learning loss because, you know, one of the main focuses of this segment is the fact that many schools now are toggling back to virtual learning because of the pandemic. There is a certain routine and rhythm to a classroom. Students, mm-hmm. Develop a relationship with the teacher. This is interrupted, as schools toggle back and forth between in-class and virtual learning. So, what steps would you advise parents and caregivers first to take to help their students, the young people in these transitions?
Sure. One, I would be optimistic. You know, this is now the second go around, maybe third for some places, not the first. Teachers are quick learners. You know, that's why they're teachers. And so I am positive that they are much better now at navigating different platforms or, activities or courses that they had to modify 2 years ago to, suddenly that now they're more prepared and ready. I know firsthand that my daughter's second grade teacher is ready to go on almost any day. And she just knows that it's so important that my kids have access to whatever kind of modality we have. I think as a parent, ask questions, don't be afraid to shoot an email to your teacher. Don't be embarrassed that you may not understand something. And then lastly, have empathy when you send those emails, right? Because just like you may be struggling in your job or as a parent in general, trying to provide supports to your children, those teachers are often parents too, right? And they are doing that same work that we are at home with your students in their classrooms and or virtually. And so ask those questions and then have empathy when you do it.
Yeah, I guess one of the biggest concerns are those children who don't have access to remote learning tools, who are doing their homework on their phones or borrowing a phone from the brother or the mom. That's really the biggest concern, one of the bigger concerns.
It is, and to me, it would be shocking right now if we didn't see that every child has access to a device that needs one because of both the influx of ARP ESSER funds and how quickly people were moving, 2 years ago to try to close that digital divide, right? I know there are still gaps. I think, New Jersey reported that they got all of their kids one-to-one by the end of 2020. I know in my school district, we had that, we are okay. I think it's unacceptable at this day and age in education and because of the pandemic that every child in a K-12 classroom isn't also issued a device. It's a critical learning tool, just as if books, pencils, glue, you name it, right? It is just as important for them to access their education.
Let me reintroduce you. Ashley Benkin is our guest. She is a former Philadelphia school district teacher and a New Jersey State policymaker and co-founder of Connected Workforce. What are some of the red flags to watch for, Ashley, that a child might be slipping in their learning or struggling during this transition?
Sure. Another great thing to look for is if they are starting to share that they, don't like school anymore, don't want to go to school, they're starting to get upset or nervous around things, something may have happened that, you know, either they're falling behind and that could be the root of some of that, or, you know, they're not comfortable, any of those kind of things. So just listen to your kids, right? Don't push away some of those ways that they're trying to vocalize their unease. I think the second step too is then make sure you know who that school counselor is. Lots of schools have invested because of ESSER funds with doubling down on their school support staff. And so that they are like incredibly helpful in situations like this. Many schools have also invested in SEL curriculum, social emotional learning curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so many educators are becoming more well-versed at, you know, taking inventory and stock of your feelings during the day, because just like adults, you know, kids can't process and learn if there's something else getting in the way, right? They could be frustrated. They could be upset. They could be hungry, for goodness sakes, right? Like there are lots of things, same as us, that can really interrupt that learning. And the pandemic has made it even harder for some that, you know, some of that stability has been taken away. And so it's really important that we're aware of those things and we don't brush them off.
We've got a question from Christine who asks, are there any efforts by education systems to adjust grade level benchmarks to reflect these learning losses? For example, where second grade starts with standards that were previously middle end of year, your first grade goals.
What a great question. There are. So I'm definitely aware that, you know, the state of New Jersey shared, here are those prioritized standards that you should be covering and focusing on. I think they also did some crosswalking with curriculum teams to say, you know, how do you blend the end of first grade with the beginning of second grade, and that, you know, you're catching and meeting kids exactly where they are. I am sure every district was working over the summer trying to do just that, and that no one was jumping in as if this year was going to be a completely normal year, and that they can just start ignoring kind of what happened the prior year.
Mm-hmm. You told producer Paige Murray.
Go ahead. The standards, just so that person understands, the standards stay the same, and we don't want to change them or lower them, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, they all build on each other. So there are ways that you can, you know, blend in that higher level thinking or that next grade thinking when you are also on grade appropriate stuff.
You were in conversation with producer Paige Murray Bessler, who was, taking notes for this show, and you told her that what COVID has shown is many school districts did not have strong, robust communication with parents. You know, there's been so much frustration on both ends, Ashley Benkin, struggles over closures, virtual learning, masking controversies. What were some of the inadequacies in communication, and how have they been made better?
Yeah, I think it's a really hard time. When I was sharing that with Paige, I was saying, you know, districts are working overtime, and when they don't have a quick way to gather feedback from their, you know, parent community, I think then it comes out on the decision-making end, right? And we see those polarizing debates because there wasn't this sense of everyone's opinion matters. We will capture that information, and here's the way that you can weigh in. Instead, it's like, hold on, you know, I need to go get my voice heard and get all riled up. And so I think I'm optimistic because there are some places that have, you know, instituted parent town halls. They have made sure Zoom meetings and, you know, virtual access to some of those decision-making meetings has continued. I think that they do even more where they survey parents multiple times throughout school years, right? To ask, how are we giving you what you need?
Okay.
Can we change our communication? And then there are places that go one step further and they translate it all, because, you know, we shouldn't ignore the fact that, you know, just because English might be the primary language in my household, that other people also can access that information that way. So sure. There are some really good exemplars, but we need to see, you know, general increase on parent communication and engagement across the board.
I'd like to spend a moment or two talking about teachers. Earlier, you called, you know, the process of getting kids caught up a Herculean task. And you also say that teachers are exhausted. You know, they're doing the math, yeah, some of them, sticking it out if they have a couple of years left. But there's also been a sharp decline in people who want to be teachers. Tell us about the support that you feel teachers could use right now, whether it's from administrators or parents, caregivers, and others.
Absolutely. It's really hard to kind of sit on the outside and put your yourself in the position of a teacher right now, but there's not enough time in the day, and there's not enough support for you to get all that you want to do done with all of your kids, right? To be that high energy person, you know, with them at all points in time. And then if you're shifting to virtual and that wasn't something that, you know, you even enjoyed, I think it's just another blow where you're like, the negative self-talk is taking over. So I think wherever districts and states, people that are in the position of power to make decisions, you know, meaning whether they be legislative or otherwise, getting teachers more time to be able to do parts of their job, taking away some of those responsibilities and distributing it across the school system instead of it being on one person's shoulders is something that will help retain people, right? Same way we do in other jobs and in other industries. I think pay incentives is something that will work for some, but even historically, just adding more money but not taking away some of the stress does not keep people for long periods of time. That might keep them for a couple years, right? But it's really going to be a multifaceted solution that both reattracts people to education in general and keeps the talented educators that we need today. And it's going to be a mix of money, reorganizing kind of who takes all these different responsibilities when it comes to each individual kid. And now each kid really needs an individualized learning plan, right? Yeah. This like one size fits all kind of worked before, not really. And now we're seeing that kids are all over the place. And so we shouldn't just be passing them through. We need to kind of drill down and say, okay, you know, Ashley really needs help in this skill set. Her phonics are low. And then, you know, in math, this is where she's at. How do we get her high dosage tutoring? How do we get her, you know, small group instruction? What other kind of interventions, you know, do we need to get? And that can't all fall on their main teacher, right? That has to be a team effort.
Yeah. A lot of work ahead, but I will have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Ashley Behnken, for your participation and for your advice. Appreciate it.
Same here. Thanks, Mary.
Ashley Behnken is co-founder of Connected Workforce and a former Philadelphia School District school teacher. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we talk about how the fashion industry, which is a big polluter, is turning around a little bit with the help of some entrepreneurs. We'll talk to Camille Tagle of FabScrap.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. One of the most exciting trends in fashion is the move towards sustainability. Millions of tons of waste fabric end up in U.S. landfills every year. And according to the World Economic Forum, the fashion supply chain is one of the planet's biggest greenhouse gas polluters. Philadelphia itself is now becoming a center of the sustainability and textile recycling movement, featuring homegrown zero-waste designers and nonprofits like FabScrap. FabScrap partners with various fashion and interior design companies and individuals to give a second life to thousands of pounds of textiles left over from the design process. It's a fascinating operation with the potential to be a sustainability game changer. And joining us now to help tell the story is Camille Tagle, co-founder and creative director of FabScrap. Hi, Camille. Welcome.
Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're really happy to have you with us today. So FabScrap originated in Brooklyn and opened its Philly location at the Bock Building a couple months ago. And from what I understand, Camille, literally hundreds, even thousands of pounds of textile leftovers are given to you by businesses and individuals. Describe what typically happens on the sixth floor of the Bock Building.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been in operation in New York for the past few years. We've just celebrated our fifth anniversary, and that was also when we opened our new Philadelphia location. But I would say, you know, to date, we've saved nearly 1 million pounds of fabric from landfill,
wow,
which is a huge amount. And that kind of gives some context to just how much waste is happening in the supply chains. But basically, once a brand decides to sign up for our recycling service, which if you imagine, you know, how cardboard or plastic recycling works, where there's, you know, a truck that shows up at your location and carts away the waste, We function pretty much exactly the same. It's just that we specialize in fabric. And so when all of those materials get collected from our brand partners, we bring it to our warehouse and sort them. And that's how we figure out how to keep them out of landfill.
Well, I was looking at some pictures of the sorting process. I mean, this operation looks like a fabric lover's fantasy. There are bolts of fabric, piles of neatly folded pieces. Describe some of the so-called waste that FabScrap receives from its partners.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I'd love to. And you're totally right. It is honestly a creative lover's dream when you walk into our reuse room. And you know, the unfortunate thing is that it is called waste, but all of the materials that we receive are anything but. I mean, we, of course, have scraps and small pieces of fabric, but we honestly rescue, you know, rolls of fabric, like fabric yardage, and full skins of leather hides, and cones of yarn, trims, literally anything that you would need to make some sort of creative project out of textiles or any apparel materials, we have, and we're able to offer that to the public at thrift store pricing.
So are there difficult fabrics to give a second life to, and what happens to them?
That's a really great question, and that's something that we explain in our volunteer program. So in order to kind of go through the volume of textile waste that we receive, we do require and rely on volunteer help, and part of that is sorting through the materials that we receive to be able to separate them by fiber type. So we do a quick orientation just to, you know, teach people who have never really interacted with fabric before. It can get pretty complex with the different compositions and fiber types, but we kind of show them what to look for. And anything that contains spandex, unfortunately, can't be downcycled into insulation. And so those are one of the fabric types that are kind of the biggest opportunity for upcycling, you know, especially when they're in small, you know, little pieces and are not yardage. That's when we have creatives who really take that opportunity to think outside the box and create just even art or really amazing pieces by thinking outside of the box and redesigning with things that typically are very difficult to reuse and normally get discarded.
So what are some of the ramifications, Camille, of the fabric that does end up in landfills?
I think, you know, it's easy to kind of get lost with, you know, thinking about all the glamour of fashion and all the beautiful materials that we receive at our warehouse and in our reuse room. But I think ultimately we have to connect that back to climate change. So any fabrics or materials that are either ending up in landfill or becoming incinerated or burned, that has a huge devastating impact on climate change. And so, you know, as much as we are so excited to see, you know, what is made from all of these fabrics and the different things that everyone is able to upcycle and different creative projects that they're able to pursue, we always want to still tie that back to the idea that they're also helping, honestly, with that goal to combat climate change.
And just let's take a moment to define upcycle, downcycle, that sort of thing, if you could.
Yeah, I'd love to get into that. So, you know, with sustainability, there are all these really fancy ways of referring to things, and that distinguishing between those two is something that we focus a lot on with our awareness and our education. So upcycling would be kind of taking something and elevating it back into another item. So basically, any sort of fabric, spandex, scrap pieces that, let's say, they're kind of like odd corners and little bits, we have some designers that upcycle them into new fabric. And what they do is they'll piece together or quilt together all those little pieces and make a new fabric and then make a new, let's say, T-shirt or dress. So that would be a really great example of upcycling. Downcycling is something, one of the ways that we keep the really small pieces out of landfill, in which they are turned into a different type of material by kind of, you know, rearranging their form and like I would say an example would be, you know, when we convert things into insulation, that process requires all the fabrics being pulled apart and all of their fibers are kind of shredded almost, if you want to imagine it that way. And then that's repurposed into different types of insulation. So you could have really compact, thick insulation for corridors. You could have really thin insulation for like moving blankets. You could have things for walls and flooring. So that would be a different way of kind of converting what the product used to be and then shredding it or pulling it apart down to insulation.
It's really exciting. Our guest is Camille Tagle, co-founder and creative director of FabScrap. Lines are open, 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Melanie asks a question. She says, I'm an upholsterer and I hate wasting scrap fabric. Do you only work with big companies with lots of fabric, or could I donate small pieces of leftover fabrics? What do you say, Camille?
I really love this question because we welcome anyone to honestly recycle with us. We do, you know, provide our service mostly to brands. However, if you wanted to drop off at our location at the Bock Building, we do allow individuals to drop off their textile waste for recycling.
Now, let's talk about some definitions in fashion, fast fashion and slow fashion. Fast fashion first, which, as I understand it, Camille, is the production of mass quantities of less expensive, trendy garments. Maybe, you know, you buy a piece, it's not particularly well made, but then maybe, you know, you could just toss it when it's out of style or falling apart. Are we seeing the beginning of the end of fast fashion?
I am very hopeful and honestly would like to say yes. I think the awareness honestly has really increased in the past few years, and I noticed that a lot more designers who are entering the industry are really thinking about every single part of the supply chain and their effects to what their own decisions in design and in building their company kind of have in terms of the long term. So that's been really amazing to see. And honestly, the more we educate, the better the understanding is, I think, not just within fashion, but also in other industries. But yes, we've definitely done a lot of work with different schools in the area, and really been challenging those designers who are about to enter the industry to rethink some of the more antiquated ways of design.
So then what is slow fashion?
To me, slow fashion is honestly just, it can take a variety of ways, but it's really thinking through all the different ways to be more environmentally conscious and also more socially conscious. I think we need to think in terms of, you know, both where we're sourcing and how we're using those resources, from, you know, sourcing the fabric to also the production and who's making our garments, and are they being treated fairly, and are they being paying a living wage? So all of those factors into design, you know, what different approaches can we take instead of, you know, the typical ways of cutting a pattern piece, maybe draping in a way where there's, you know, less cuts required and therefore less waste. So just so many different ways, I think, in structuring, you know, a company, whether it's in fashion or elsewhere, to basically think through all the different steps and understand one's kind of effect from each of those parts.
So when a company sends FabScrap a load of fabrics, you know, or zippers or buttons, apparently you weigh it all, and then the brand gets an environmental impact report. What does the company learn about its process, essentially about how to perhaps do it better?
Absolutely. And that is something that we're really proud to share with our brand partners. So every year, a brand will receive kind of almost a report card, like a total of pounds that they've recycled with us. And we break that down and what that means in terms of carbon offset and also what that means in terms of trees planted. but it gives a breakdown of, you know, what percentage of the total pounds they've recycled with us ended up being reused and into our thrift store system, how much of that actually was downcycled into insulation, and then how much of it had really no choice but to go to landfill. And so I think when brands have this report card generated for them and have all of this information at their disposal, it really allows them to reevaluate internally what some of their sourcing decisions are. Maybe they want to invest in fabrics that have less spandex, knowing that spandex is something that mm-hmm. we can't recycle easily. Yeah. It really is a guide and a tool for them to evaluate their own business practices.
We've got a tweet from Sandy who says, fabric and waste from a garment but from before a garment is even put on display takes up so much more space in landfills than people realize. It's insane. And then an email from Julia who says, when my mother was a girl, her mom made quilts out of pieces from a factory that had men's wool scraps. You know, back in the day when people didn't have as much, there wasn't much that was wasted.
100%. And even, you know, in Italy, for example, there are people who are called, I think, raggers, and they would go around and pick up everyone's fabric scraps and clothing scraps and actually make paper with it. So it's something that honestly I think we've just become a little out of touch with in terms of really valuing our resources and understanding that, you know, not everything is automatically waste. There are so many different ways to like look at what we have called waste lately and really, you know, trying to understand like the value of it and the resources that went into it in order to be a little bit more eco-friendly and a little bit more conscious about our impact.
I imagine that with some of the fabric pieces that you have at the Bach building, that there can be some really fantastic pieces of clothing made.
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, to be able to have this available to the public and have the public gain access to all of these things that end up in landfill is something that very personally is near and dear to me. My background is in design, and I was one of the people who kind of contributed to the issues when I was working in the fashion industry. And, you know, it was mind-blowing for me to learn as I was designing just how much reusable fabric goes to landfill. Yeah. I would say of the total amount that we collect from our brand partners, about 60% is actually completely usable.
Wow.
And again, that's, you know, full rolls of fabric and, you know, hides, leather hides or fur hides that haven't even been touched. And a lot of those things, and I can speak firsthand, a lot of those things are thrown, honestly, because of just simple design changes or, you know, certain sales changes or things that happen just during that that process. And so for me to see, you know, students being able to take advantage of these materials and really, you know, enhance their projects and their knowledge of design by having access to it, or having entrepreneurs, you know, say that having access to this also allows them to really grow their business. It's something really meaningful, and everyone kind of wins because it's another way of keeping these materials out of landfill.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we only have about 30 seconds left, but is there a piece that stands out in your mind that was made from some of this repurposed fabric that you could describe for us?
Oh my gosh, we've seen so many beautiful and amazing things, but we are also really happy to have a featured designer program, which we'll be launching immediately in Philadelphia in the next week or so. So for anyone who is interested in visiting our warehouse, definitely come by the Bach building or check out our website, fabscrap.org.
And you love your volunteers too, and they are rewarded. If you love
absolutely,
fabric.
Absolutely, right? Yes. Anyone who volunteers with us, we give a special 5-pound fabric thank you that they can take home with them.
All right, Camille Tagle, such an interesting and enlightening conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Best of luck. Camille Tagle is co-founder and creative director of FabScrap. Our engineer today is Al Banks, our producer, Paige Mary Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you with us, and be well.